Hi, I'm Derek McFadden, proud to be an author, a poet, and a lover of most things pop culture. I am also handicapped, born with a mild form of cerebral palsy. But please note, this podcast is not called Handicapped Writer. It is instead titled Writing While Handicapped, because that's what I do. Join me as we talk with folks in the book world, and this podcast looks at the world of literature from a perspective you haven't seen before. Welcome into a brand new episode of Writing While Handicapped. I'm Derek McFadden. I'm the author of What Death Taught Terrence, The Santa Claus Agreement. And I am here with debut author. His new book is The Other Valley. It's Scott Alexander Howard, everybody. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about The Other Valley. What is the conceit, as it were?
Okay, yeah, the conceit is that, it takes place in a small town, which, you know, is kind of old-fashioned place. And if you go across the mountains to the east, the exact same town reappears, but there it is 20 years ahead in time. And if you go across the mountains to the west, there it's 20 years in the past. And presumably these kind of stretch on forever in both directions. So it's kind of a weird, magic realist vision of eternity, I guess. And traveling between these valleys is strictly forbidden because you can mess up the timeline. So there's a lot of security, there's a lot of taboos, but there's one exception to that, which is that if you are grieving, you can ask for special permission to go to the past, which is just a hike. You know, they let you through the border, that you're escorted there under armed guard, and you're not allowed to interfere with anything there, but you are allowed to look at your lost loved one in a place where they're still alive. So some people find this consoling. It's called a morning tour, the slang in the book.
And where did the idea come from? Where did that idea come from for you?
This idea, I don't know where it came from. I know exactly where I was when I had the idea, which was a long time ago, a long time before I actually did anything with the story. I had this image in my head. It came in sort of the days leading up to the death of a friend. She had ovarian cancer and she had moved into hospice. Mm-hmm. And so we were all kind of just, you know, sitting there. And I remember having this image pop into my head, which is just of this same town repeating over and over and over again, separated in time from its neighbors. And I think that the kind of personal context of when I had this idea kind of informed why I always thought that time travel in this world was going to be about primarily used for mourning and grieving, rather than something more like action oriented. It was always much more of an emotional thing. I think that's probably where that came from.
As far as change, there's no change. It's more about, can I see this person again?
Yes.
When I read it, it really hit me because it's been 20 years since I lost my grandfather. So
yeah.
20 years is 20 years, but I think the 20 year idea just hit me as like, well, yeah, I get that. I would, but then I thought, would I go back? Because at that time, you know, he had cancer. So it made me think about my own life. Would I have gone back? Would I have done that? Because it was so painful at the time, you know? So tell us about your two main characters. Who are they?
So the main character, the protagonist who narrates the book, her name is Odile. And when we meet her, she's 16 years old. She's very, very shy. She's deathly shy, doesn't talk very much to anybody. And she doesn't stay a teenager for the entire book. We kind of follow her into her adulthood. And the book is split into two halves by this 20-year gap. So we
I didn't know how much you wanted to, I didn't know how much that you wanted to, like, you know, so I was kind of letting you do that. But okay, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I won't talk about her circumstances, I suppose, in part two, because that's a bit of a spoiler. Although some reviewers are now just helping themselves do it. So that, I guess I'd have to get used to it.
I'm not going to do that here because I will say I read the book on audio. I'm legally blind. So I read the book on audio and immediately ordered it after finishing it and started it again. Because because my immediate thought was, how did he do that? I'm a writer too. And I just thought, how did he do that? I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry. Continue the...
Not at all. No, that's great to hear. My agent said, you know, when we first met, she's like, I really just wanted to go back to the start and read the beginning in context, since it kind of goes back that way anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, she, Odile is, she's very shy. And the story in the first half is kind of her coming out of her shell a little bit. It's a bit of a coming of age. And the circumstances in which she does this are kind of fraught because What happens is she sees some visitors from the future who are hanging around near her school, and she puts together what she's not supposed to do, but she recognizes who they are. And they're supposed to be anonymous. When you come back in time on one of these morning tours, one of the rules is that you're not to be recognized because that could influence, people's present. And so she kind of breaks the rules by recognizing who they are, and that allows her to put together that they're here to visit one of her classmates who is still alive in her present, but must have passed away in within 20 years' time. And so now she has this kind of terrible secret, this foreknowledge about one of her classmates who is, doesn't suspect a thing. And he is the other, I suppose, main character, and that's
That's the
Ed
key.
May. And Ed May is kind of, if Odile is sort of the shy part of myself that I parceled into that character, I think Ed May is sort of the more irreverent and absurd part of myself. He's much more lively. He is a violin prodigy, and he is sort of vying to be part of this conservatory, this musical organization in this small town, and dealing with some friction with his parents and so forth. But yeah, it's a little bit of a tender kind of love story that develops between them. But the only issue is that she happens to secretly know that he is probably doomed.
The book reminds me a lot of The Giver. Did you read The Giver as when it came out or around when it came out, or do you
I
know what
did
that
not.
book?
So I do know The Giver because I've been hearing about the, I hadn't, I, you know, I think I'd heard of it. I think this is the first interview where we talked about The Giver. So I think I'd heard of it from, so my wife taught advanced enrichment to, I think, kids between grades 2 and 8, and they were really into The Giver. And so I think I'd heard of it through them. And now I'm having adult readers who are saying like, "Oh, this is nostalgic for me because the vibe is sort of like The Giver." So I do need to read The Giver. I have not read it though.
It's really interesting to me. Like the first half reminds me a lot of The Giver. And then I was like, and I was like, I'm wondering what he's gonna do with the plot in the second half. And the second half is wholly original. Is that's it's just amazing to me because having read The Giver, I was like, it's interesting because The Giver, it ends where your part one ends, basically, but there's no resolution. And so it was, I was like, oh, I get to see what happens. I hope you take that as a compliment because I love both books. I don't know how much you want to say about what she is heading towards as part one is happening. Odile is attempting to get a job in the future because everybody has a certain job in this future. Do you want to say anything about that? I'm sorry, I'm trying not to spoil anything.
Oh, I think, I mean, I think spoiling is okay, and especially if it's in the first half. I mean, some of the stuff was on the jacket copy too. It's not a problem. I think that so Odile, she's being pressured by her mother to try to become what's called a conseiller, and so the sort of municipal government, sort of the highest level of government in this world, because the world is just a town, is called the conseil. And what the conseil does with relation to the borders of the town is they regulate who is allowed to go on these kind of grieving tours. And so what they do is they hear petitions from applicants who are saying, "Here's why I deserve to be able to, go to the past to see my lost loved one, or go to the future to see somebody who, is going to be born after I die, but who I really want to see." They are the regulators of the borders and the travel applications, and they say no a lot of the time. And Odile, somewhat improbably, is chosen to be part of a vetting program to become an apprentice conseiller. So if this is just a test, she has kind of a 1 month trial period where every week various students around her get cut, and they don't actually make the grade. They can't continue on to be apprentices. But she's vying to basically be kind of one of the valley's sort of grief experts who adjudicates these cases as to whether you're allowed to go back and mourn in this way or not. And it's a very high pressure and prestigious kind of job in the town.
I loved her relationship with her mother in that first half because it is and actually all throughout, because I think it shows how your relationship changes with a parent when you're a child, and then when you become an adult, how the relationship changes for, I would say, for the child, but not necessarily for the parent, because the parent always feels like they're parenting. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it's a they have a hard relationship, but I enjoyed kind of, I'd say like overall it's a pretty brittle relationship. They have a hard time together. At the same time, I enjoyed injecting moments of warmth and levity into that. I found
Yes.
it quite a relief as a writer to sort of have them have happy moments too. But yeah, it's a tense and somewhat estranged relationship, especially later in the book.
All right, I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to spoil anything. So I'm trying to talk around it. I'm just basically saying, you guys, you should read this book because I wish we could all talk about it. Like actually talk about the whole thing. It's perfect for book clubs. I guess I'll ask you, how long did this take to conceive? And then how long was the writing process for you? From conception to book, how long did that take?
The first image came 10 years ago this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the friend who I mentioned, she passed away. And then I thought that's a cool idea. And I
Yeah.
think for a split second I thought like I could see that being like a movie or something. Maybe I'll try to do a screenplay of it. And then but I was still an academic at that time. I was in philosophy, and that's pretty much a full-time job if you're trying to get a job as an academic. All you're doing is teaching and trying to publish, and
Oh,
in
sure.
the rat race of permanent job application season. And so I didn't have time to do anything with it. I would kind of return to the idea, jot a couple of notes. And every time I returned to the idea, I thought, like, that's still cool. I still like that. I still kind of want to hear where that story goes.
Yeah.
But it was a few years before I actually started thinking that maybe philosophy had run its course for me and that I should actually try to do this. So I would say that, yeah, I remember I started the first draft of it in earnest in 2018. And it took me about 3 years to write it with a pretty concentrated work. And then, things take forever to get published, so it's been done for a couple of years at this point.
Yeah, I mean, querying is querying.
Yeah.
If you guys haven't written for authors, querying is hell. I'm
Oh
just
yeah.
going to say, I'm just gonna, I mean that it's like if you said, "Hey, you're really good at this. Do you want to spend 8 years, giving a job interview to people you don't know?" That sounds great. That's
Oh,
what
it is
querying
so
is.
hard. It is so hard. I had a in retrospect, it was a mercifully short time at the time though. So it took me 5 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But for those 5 months, it
Yeah.
was, you're like, well, this is the rest of my life because there's no light anywhere at all. I didn't get, any bites until those 5 months.
Well, and the thing about it that you're told is, and I've been told this by agents is, no one's going to love your book as much as you love your book. So you have to go all in and make someone love your book as much as you love it. And sometimes I remember querying my own book going, "Well, I love it, but I don't know, I can't force anybody to love
Yeah,
it."
absolutely. And it also it can make somebody love it as much as you love it within, 200 words. And
Yeah.
you're one of 100 emails they got that day.
And make them feel like they can sell it within a genre, within their wants for genres. That's why I think it's so hard for like genre bending books, which I think yours sort of is. So part of me, as I was reading this, was like, I was just happy for you that it sold because it's so cool. But I think sometimes stories get boiled down to, is this a thriller? Is this a tearjerker? Is this it can it's only can be one thing, and I feel like yours is too, because the second half is very much, it feels like a thriller to me. Will the ending that we all want happen? How would it happen if it did? What was the for you going from the first part, which is Odile at 16, to the second part? I mean, they aren't different books, but it's almost like layering on a difference. If you had two short stories that connected, that's essentially to me what this novel is. So, did you have to be in a different headspace for the second one than for the first?
I didn't think so at the time. To me, it felt pretty natural. I always knew I was going to jump forward. Given the conceit, it felt like perverse not to do it. It's like I have
Yeah,
to do
yeah,
it.
exactly,
Yeah.
right.
And so I did it, and it was just kind of exciting to me because what, without giving spoilers, what happens in the second half of the book is that in one way, her life shrinks a little bit. Because she's experienced a major disappointment. But on the other hand, as a reader, you get to learn a lot more about the mechanics of this world. And so the focus kind of widens. You see sort of more about the social organization. You see more about the way that the kind of time travel conceit plays out. You do get to visit these other valleys, which in the first half you don't. They're just this kind of rumor on the edge of
Right.
everyone's life. So that was kind of, in a way, the trade-off at the start. was okay, so some bad things happen in part one that are going to be hard to read, but then in part two we kind of get this like, okay, we're learning them, and then all that stuff from part one kind of circles back and we get there again.
Yeah, if you guys like the Twilight Zone, this is a very Twilight Zone book in the best way possible.
That's a good, yeah.
I love Twilight Zone, so yeah.
It's a good kind of genre comparison, honestly. We were talking about genre, and the Twilight Zone is a show that was able to just say like each episode we're just going to be like slightly different from reality, but we can
Yeah.
decide how to do that, and the rules will change. I feel like this is kind of like that too. It's just like it doesn't take it's speculative fiction in the sense that it doesn't take our reality for granted. It does, shift some things. But yeah, I think the Twilight Zone is
Yeah.
great.
Well, the funny thing about that, when The Twilight Zone was made, nobody had put science fiction on TV. So Serling could basically do whatever he wanted, and they'd be like, oh, that's cool. Because we don't know what the difference is between cool and uncool at this point, which is why he was allowed to make which is why he was allowed to make episodes that made absolutely no sense in certain parts. Just like, oh,
I
that
guess
one
this is
didn't really
cool.
work. Okay, so I don't know how much more you want to say without spoiling. I mean, my question would be more about the philosophical stuff, because you come out of philosophy, and I think for a book like this, that is your superpower as far as the writing goes, because you change the genre in a way. You add the philosophy, that if I were writing this, I wouldn't know enough to add the philosophy. It would probably be a more action oriented, but it would also not be as deep and impactful. So how did you decide what philosophy to follow when you were writing this? Like, what philosophies to focus on?
I think that the philosophical stuff, the book is not kind of didactic in the sense that, like, I'm not
It's
really sort
not.
of imparting messages. And I think
No.
that it's more a temperamental thing. Like, when you say, like, which kind of philosophy, I think that the role that it played for me was almost like a temperamental or stylistic approach, maybe more than like in terms of the content. And I mean, there
Sure.
is some philosophical content too. And I mean, there's, if you've read any philosophy about, personal identity thought experiments, like what happens if you split a brain in two or something. There's a little bit of like, there's kind of a sci-fi wing of philosophy that I think did influence
Right.
me a little bit.
My point is, it's not going to overwhelm the reader with philosophy, but but you can tell that you've been through it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think that another way that it kind of is present in the background of the story, and it's like, it's a story first and foremost, but I think this stuff kind of like percolates behind it. Some of the operations of the Conseil, that kind of governing body of the town and of these valleys, some of the sort of moral questions they consider when they decide whether to allow somebody to go back in time to view a lost loved one, some of those questions become a little bit philosophical. So
Right.
maybe that's one of the ways in which it's most overt in the book.
And we get to see, like you said in part two, kind of how it works a little bit. And as you said, the scope kind of widens. I really loved the scene, which, I mean, I don't think spoils anything, but it's with the older man who goes back to see his granddaughter, who he never really met. I thought that was a beautiful, again, 20 years after I lost my grandfather. So reading that, I was like, oh, all he wanted was that moment. And this one is going, it's going to make you guys tear up. If it doesn't, you probably don't have a heart, or you're stone. I don't know. And I will say, I'm not going to give anything away, obviously, but the ending you got, I mean, the ending you came up with, I was like, how is he going to end it? And the ending you came up with is so beautiful.
Thank you.
It's just a really beautiful ending. Your grasp of the language was also, it's because this book could be written as a like straight across thriller, but it's very literary, but not in a like, I'm being literary sense. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're doing, but you don't hammer us with it, which I think is a skill, because I've known so many authors who say, I need to show you every word that
Yeah, I've read those books.
know. What's next for you? Do you have a second book coming, or?
I do. Yeah, it's under contract,
Okay.
so I do have to write
Good for you.
it. Thanks. Yeah, it's it was gonna be speculative too, and then it's
Huh?
actually kind of as I'm drafting it, I'm finding myself moving more and more back towards the real world.
Really? Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and it's I don't know what's harder, honestly, like coming up with an entire world from scratch. Felt like a lot of work at the time, especially when there's sort of time travel paradoxes to avoid. I had a big chart and all that stuff just to keep
Oh
it straight for
God,
myself.
I
I
would
didn't
have
really.
had note cards and everything else. So I get that.
So that, it feels like, oh gosh, I wish I could just, especially because of the conceit of the book, the world is just this one town. And so because it's just a town that's landlocked, there's a lake, but there's mountains and that's it. I found I couldn't use words like oceanic, for example, because I felt like that's
Right.
a, and there's a little bit of cheating about that because obviously our words all come from a world where, other things exist. But still, I
Right.
didn't want to have these obvious kind of, they're not anachronisms, but they're kind of the equivalent of that spatially, like things that
Yeah,
wouldn't
well, I
work
mean,
them.
because they would be in that world. Right.
So, that
So
was a lot of work to navigate. But, now that I'm writing a real world setting, that's also a lot of work too. I feel like just kind of crafting a tone within the world we all know, because I'm also not free to change things the way that I was in the first book.
right. Describe for us the moment when you, like the very first moment you held the hardcover book in your hands. What did that feel like? My debut novel. I remember, so I've got mine over here. He's on video, you guys. This is an audio podcast, but I got mine over here. So I remember when I first held Terrence, what that felt like. What did it feel like for you? And did you get to share it with people who have known you as a writer, or that you've wanted to write for a while, like family and friends?
I did, yeah. I'm starting to been mailing it out to people. I got it a couple of weeks ago, I guess. And there's a hardcover from the U.S. and then in Canada it goes straight to trade paperback because the books in Canada cost so much. So we pretty much do everything paperback first. Yeah, it's really expensive. So I have these two versions of it. And yeah, it's honestly just like kind of surreal. I don't know. Like I want to be able to say like I had this really emotional moment, but I was kind of like, oh wow. Like I think that a lot of people, when I've watched their kind of unboxing videos, have a similar reaction where they're just like, huh, this is a real thing. I don't even know how to process it.
Having written the first one and having had that experience, the second novel that I wrote, so I have cerebral palsy, and the conceit of the second novel for me was, what if a boy who was like 7 asks Santa to take his palsy away, and that Christmas it doesn't happen, so of course he's angry, and the next Christmas Santa's sad that he couldn't help, so he takes him to the North Pole. So it's essentially like Polar Express, but with palsy, and then there's an adult storyline. And it was supposed to be a short story, and I just had to grab on for dear life and hold on, and ended up being a novel. But the funny part was, about halfway through, in my own head, I saw the book fully formed. I saw the book with a cover and everything, and I'd never done that before. So I'm hoping for you that you can just imagine your next novel as, just imagine it like in front of you and just be like, yeah, I see it. I see it.
This will happen. This is possible to do again.
It was very helpful. And but then I also was just like, okay, you can't lose this. You know how like you have the muse and you don't lose it. Oh gosh. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of what my thought process was. Just, I can't possibly lose this. I know what it is. And if I can just hold on for dear life, I can make it happen. And I did.
So there was
And
a security to the vision, right?
there was also, I had a publisher who wanted it at that time. So like you do. So knowing that it, and I don't know if this is true for you, but knowing that your writing has somewhere to go makes it easier to kind of speculatively write. And I don't mean like speculative fiction. I mean like write on spec, essentially. I don't know how that, if that's how you feel.
Yeah, I think it's one of those trade-offs. I think that because the book has sold, there's a certain pressure that it creates that the first book, this is sort of notorious. You write your first book and you're just kind of like you're just winging it. You don't know, no one is asking for it, presumably. You're just doing it by yourself. And so there's a great freedom to that. Nobody's watching, nobody's waiting. But it's also terrifying, especially once you get to the querying stage. You're like, oh, well, I didn't mean to spend 3 years writing this or however long it took. And now I've invested a lot more time than I expected. So it matters to me that it finds a home. That's sort of the fear of the first novel before you've got a contract. And then the second book, now it's kind of like you can imagine people sort of watching from afar and being like, okay, where is it? And that's its own kind of pressure. I think it's still less scary, though, than the fear of the abyss in the first book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, and there is a thought, I think, too, of like the people who read my first book will follow me to the second. And can I make them happy? I had a friend, so obviously I read a lot. I'm assuming you read a lot. I had a friend who does not read a lot, plays video games. And I asked her, I said, why don't you read a lot? And she said, when I read books, I'm with it. I'm with a book until they do something I wouldn't have done. And I'm like, wow, that's not what reading is. Because to me, reading is an implicit contract between the reader and the author that the author will write something and the reader will read it and take it in and experience it and react at the end. I don't know. I mean, there are those DNF books, but is that how you feel about reading or?
That's a really interesting position that your friend articulates, and I mean, I tend to think that that would be a pretty restrictive. I mean, I can see why you don't end up reading very much if that's your position, because so much of crafting a story is creating conflict. And at least in this book, I start out with somebody who she makes a lot of decisions that I think readers don't want her to make, but the trick is to try to bring the reader along with that and have them be like, okay, I don't want her to do this. I'm very upset that she's doing this. However, I can see why she's doing this, and I can imagine a version of myself where I did this. I feel like that kind of expansion, so you sort of, it's like an inception. You sort of like plant the idea
It
into
is,
the reader's mind, like, okay, what if I was doing this though? Oh no, then this is how that would feel. So it's, yeah, that's kind of how I see most like narrative fiction as working.
I'm going to do some housekeeping real quick. Writing While Handicapped is a podcast solely owned by the authors on the Air Global Radio Network. If our listeners want to get in touch with you online, how would they do that?
My website is scottalexanderhoward.com. So I'm one of those guys with three first names. I use them all. scottalexanderhoward.com, and there you'll find like links to order the book, any kind of news. And also, I'm on Instagram. The handle is just the same. It's at Scott Alexander Howard. And that's pretty much the extent of my presence.
We will put those in the show notes, and I very much appreciate the chance to read this early. I want to thank your publisher for sending me an audiobook version, an audio file, so that I could read it early and then read it again after I was done reading it. And if it were up to me, this book would be huge, Scott. So I hope it is. You've got some great characters. Even the side characters are just so well drawn. So you guys need to pick this up. The Other Valley, by the time it's up, or by the time this is up, it will be out. So you guys should pick it up. And that is this episode of Writing While Handicapped. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks so much for
Okay.
having me.